What's up, guys? This is Mike Kazzy. This is the Brute Strength Podcast. This week, I interviewed Andre LeBay in New Orleans, Louisiana. Andre has been a rehab specialist and strength and conditioning coach for the past 20-plus years. He's worked with hundreds, if not thousands, of high school athletes. He's worked with PGA Tour players, and he was most recently the physical therapist for the New Orleans Saints. We talk a lot about injury prevention and how to bulletproof yourself if you're an athlete, or your athletes if you're a coach. We talk about how to develop athletic potential, etc. Enjoy the show. What's up, guys? This is Mike Kazzy. This is the Brute Strength Podcast. I'm here with Andre LeBay. We're in New Orleans, Louisiana at Total Package Wellness and Performance.
Yep.
Andre has been in the strength and conditioning, rehab, etc. field for the last 20 plus years. He's worked with young kids, high school athletes, collegiate athletes, professional athletes in every sport, from professional golf to he was the physical therapist for the New Orleans Saints. So we have a wealth of knowledge here, and I'm excited to start picking his brain a little bit.
Nice to be here.
Thanks for doing this, man. So I told you a little bit ago that when I came, so a little background, I came in here before a lumbar fusion two and a half years ago, and Andre within 5 minutes knew that my hip rotators were weak and that was causing a lot of issue. And I went on to figure out that is probably why I put a lot of extra stress on my low back and whatnot, and that was kind of the catalyst. So my first question is, what caused you, like, why did you check my hip rotators, and what did that tell you?
Well, all this stuff that we've been doing for the last 10 and 15 years is really based off some work we did out of the Czech Republic with a guy named Vladimir Janda, and it's been trying to figure out how to look for markers that would tell us if a person has a motor, a movement pattern issue, if they've lost the ability to move, if they've forgotten how to move in certain patterns, and certain patterns that you would expect them to be able to move naturally, honestly, with either a sedentary lifestyle, so someone who's worked out but then stopped working out, or just hasn't ever actually moved in patterns that they did when they were 15, 16, 17, they lose those patterns. After injury, they lose those patterns. And also when they do the same repetitive activities over and over again, they actually stop utilizing the body as efficiently as they think they did, because the body needs to be stimulated certain ways. One of the things we've learned over time is that there are certain areas in the body that you can kind of predict when this person's either set themselves up for an injury as an active injury going on, or maybe someone that's predisposed for a problem. And one of the major areas is the glute max or glute med, and especially the hip rotators. It's an easy thing to pick out. If you look at any of the functional movement screen programs that are out there, one of the things we utilize is a functional squat. Well, one of the things we look at a functional squat is the activity of the glute at the bottom of the squat. In a static position, and this is something that we learned from the Czech Republic, is that the starting position of every movement is in stance, anatomical position. You can predict how they're going to move based on where the muscle's tone is in that anatomical position. It's either going to be active and have a amount of resting tone that's normal, or it'll be inhibited. The inhibited tells us that there's something not working. If it's overactivated, it tells us it's working overtime, even in stance. So those are the things we kind of looked at, and it doesn't tell us the answer, but it tells us we have to dig, right, that there's something going on.
Look deeper into that. Yeah. Is there a word that you can use to describe, like, what is the correct tonality in the glute, for instance?
So mostly what we're looking at is an asymmetry. Okay. So it's really the number one thing we find is the body does not lose function or have injury symmetrically.
Right.
It's always asymmetric. There's functional asymmetry and pathologic asymmetry. So our Olympic lifters are usually symmetrical athletes. So I would not look at someone who's Olympic lifted all their life and see a huge asymmetry left to right.
Why is that?
Because most of their lifts are done with the body being loaded, both arms, both feet at the same time. You take that model, but then you apply it to a baseball pitcher, and there are functional asymmetries that are just there. If you're a right-handed pitcher, you're always throwing with your right hand overhead and your left arm tucked in. Mm-hmm. You're also landing on your front side hip. You're pushing off your backside hip. So the initiation of the movement and the catching of the movement makes the hips work actually differently. One's working concentrically while the other one's working eccentrically. That creates this asymmetry that if you didn't know what you were looking at would say, oh, something's wrong. But because we would know their history, it's okay. As opposed to that, you look at volleyball players or softball players. They have some of the same asymmetries that you can kind of predict what you would see when the athlete looks in. If a pitcher came to me and their dominant shoulder was higher than the non-dominant shoulder, there's something going on. There's either a scoliosis, this person has an upper trap activation, there's something going on that could cause this person. So some asymmetries are normal and some are not. And you have to be able to pick out which ones are normal and not.
Okay. What are your – this might be a tough question. What are your top three resources, whether it be a book or an online resource, to learn about – say functional movement and symmetry.
Some stuff that came out of Gray Cook and Mike Voigt, mm-hmm. those guys. The functional movement screen stuff is something that anyone can get into and look at from just the standpoint of if you have an arsenal of things that you could use to tease out some things that may be blatant. That's one thing to look at. Mm-hmm. There's a Yonda approach to musculoskeletal evaluation. That's a book that's out there that you can look into. I would highly recommend that if you really want to get into this stuff, you actually go to a course taught by someone that's either with functional movement screens or Yonda approach, and any of the things when you look at imbalances, and go through the course, because there's a lab component that you have to kind of go into with this.
Actually practice it.
You have to be practicing in front of it and know what you're looking at. You know, anyone can look at a movement and they can tell 10 different things. But if you learn what to look at, you can all start speaking the same language of, okay, now I see where that muscle should do this and not do this. And we used to think it was, you know, anatomical position and origin, insertion, and contraction. That's how it works. But what we've learned even more so is the body thinks of movement not as single plane activity. So the bicep, if we think of it as a curl, really, yes, we know it does that. But functionally, it doesn't really do that. Most of the time, it's working eccentrically through a throw,
right,
that kind of thing. The other thing to remember is the body looks at movement as slings, loops, and chains, meaning when you walk, you don't think about firing glute med, you don't think about firing this. But when you walk, you also walk with opposite arm, opposite leg going forward. That is a functional movement that has to happen. If you tried to train someone without keeping that in mind, you would lose something in the training. So the idea is, once you learn how the body thinks of movement and that is a total body functional movement, that's why all these functional movement approaches have come out. Mm-hmm. That's also why we feel that the Olympic lifts are a superior way of training, because it trains a whole functional movement. I mean, the clean and jerk and the snatch are very beautiful and dynamic movements, also very dangerous, but it's also these things that you notice why these athletes reach peak performance when their exercise and their strength training is based on components of those lifts. That's why, you know, the total body lifts are the way to really go, because it stimulates the whole system. Also keep in mind that you're not stimulating a musculoskeletal system. It's actually a nervous system you're stimulating. Mm-hmm. If you're strength training a client or you're doing strength training, you're actually adapting your nervous system, number one, and the musculoskeletal system follows suit. Also, the first thing you lose is the neural adaptation. So if you're going to predict an injury, check how fast they fire a muscle, what their balance is, because then the athletes actually started to digress before you even notice it, that kind of thing.
What do you do to test that?
Very simple test. It's just a single limb stance test. We actually have the athlete stand on one leg, hip at 45, knee at 90. Mm-hmm. They look at a spot on the wall, and we have them balance there. Once they've kind of figured out what the balance feels like, we'll let them put their foot back down. They kind of go back to steady state, do the same activity again, but this time I close their eyes. As soon as they close their eyes, I start counting. It should be 10 to 15 seconds without them making a voluntary movement to stabilize themselves. Mm-hmm. Once they make a movement to stabilize, the test stops.
Gotcha.
This is a test that's traditionally people score bad in the United States, just because we're very shoe people and we like to wear our Crocs and we're not barefoot a lot and we don't walk as much as other countries do to and from. But if you look at an asymmetry left and right, again, if one side scores 10 seconds left leg and 4 seconds right leg, it may give us an idea of where that person is.
Okay.
The other thing is age. Over the age of, unfortunately, over the age of like 25, 30, you start losing balance. Mm-hmm. It's just because we stop stimulating the system. You know, mm-hmm. you're not skateboarding at 35 anymore. You're doing other things that may not stimulate that nervous system the right way.
Right. Man, you said so many things just now that I want to pick at. I don't even know where to start. So you're talking about the Olympic lifts being very holistic. They obviously improve or help athletes get to their peak athletic shape. When do you use single, unilateral exercises?
We use that as an adjunct movement. Mm-hmm. If I see a blatant asymmetry in someone, meaning I don't think there's a pathology underlining, they're just someone that overdeveloped one side as opposed to the other, I'll use single plane, single-sided exercises to up-train that one side. After injury, I will up-train that side to try and bring back to symmetry. But as soon as I can, I want to kind of go back to symmetrical movements, opposite arm, opposite leg movements, and base those movements on, we know this, the body learns to move in certain ways. It learns to crawl, roll, squat. Those are, you don't teach a 2-year-old how to squat. They know how. Unfortunately, we got to teach 50-year-olds how to squat because they forget how. Mm-hmm. So if you use that as your baseline and base all of your exercises on that, you're strength training, but you're also stimulating the system and teaching it in a way it likes to learn, not just force feeding it how to learn.
Right.
So in unilateral activities, I think are great. I think it should not be the baseline of a strength training program. It should be an adjunct part of it. I mean, in our training sessions with our clients, after we've done our main program, we call it the gun show. Mm-hmm. Guys, go work on it. What you want to work on? You can want to do bench press? Great. Go do it now. Do bicep. Knock yourself out.
Right.
Go if you want. I mean, because those muscles do look good with your shirt off.
Right.
So that's, you have to kind of have a balance. I mean, there's a little bit of vanity in this stuff
sure.
too.
Yeah, and part of that is just getting the athletes to adhere to what you're telling them, right? And if they look better, they're going to be, more apt to follow your direction, right? I'm curious, what specifically? How do you do? Like, so you're talking about upworking after an injury, or if you see an asymmetry, specifically, how do you do that?
So what we would normally do is do some form of initiate everything with closed chain balance training. That may be upper body and that may be lower body. The reason we do that, it creates a co-contraction of the joint and then allows me to load them after that. So
That's
I would
a
not
hot word right there. Co-contraction.
Yeah. So what we want to do is once the joint's stable, I can then load it asymmetrically. So if I'm working on the elbow, let's say I have a Tommy John reconstruction, and I really do want to do biceps activation. It's just one of those things. I would probably do that, put that person into a push-up hold position and maybe do just arm, hand rotations left, rotations right, put them on a hiding board with their hands on a kind of a slippery surface, and they can do circles left, circles right while loading in a push-up position. Then I would go into eccentric loading of the bicep, concentric loading of the tricep, and then reverse that. I may do concentric of the bicep, eccentric of the tricep, and start training that muscle. But also remember, if I do it to one part of the complex, I want to do it to the other part of the complex, and I want to train both muscles concentrically and eccentrically slowly, and then also increase speed if I can. I mean, the plyometric,
on the concentric
portion, right? Yeah. That's probably, if that would be the model I would go after with a torn ACL, I would actually do the same thing with core work. If it was a low back surgery, I would start off with something to co-contract all the muscles around there and then start working into rotational planes, that kind of
thing. So what do you run into if you don't start with that?
Then you're putting the cart before the horse.
Okay.
You will set yourself up for failure. The one of the main reasons we got into this, unfortunately, is because we would do rehab on clients and then send them out into the world of personal training and strength training. And honestly, we didn't know where they were going and who they were seeing. And we started seeing recurrence of injuries. Maybe not the primary injury we sent them out for. So it could have been let's say someone came with a hip pathology. We sent them out. All of a sudden, now they have meniscus issues in the knee. So it for us, it was more of an issue of how do you create an environment that you can, number one, have a crutches to cleats model where they come off of an injury and get back to full function. But also now our prevention model was born out of that. Well, golly, we know how to get them back on the field And we know this works, and their performance is even better than it was before. So somewhere in the middle there is where our performance training began. That's where we started kind of – and honestly, we learned a ton from strength coaches. I think the biggest vat of knowledge that's unused right now is Division I level strength coaches. Mm-hmm. These guys know a ton. They've figured it out even without help.
Right.
And what we've done is kind of be able to talk their language, and then they then have gleaned off of us – oh, now I understand why this works. Mm-hmm. And to me, it just makes a big, a much better synergistic relationship.
Absolutely.
That helps everything.
Absolutely.
You know?
And I don't think there are many out there, are there, speaking both languages, strength coach and research?
From being in the seeing it in the pro level and the college level, unfortunately, there's always a wall between the athletic training room and the strength conditioning mm-hmm. program. And that wall is also indicative of the communication that goes back and forth usually. And to be honest with you, I mean, sometimes, you know, the strength coaches don't want to deal with someone with an incision on their leg. And they see that person as not being ready and maybe still being broken. And on the flip side, the trainers and PTs are like, well, this big, heavy, strong guy doesn't need me. He's all you. Well, I think both sides need to learn a little bit more about what the other one does, because it really helps when getting the athlete back. And also we learned that what happened in the weight room, I would be easier to let my athlete into the weight room,
right,
and with certain parameters. Coach, you can do all you want to here, but on these things here, we can't do it. And what it would spawn is a question, well, why can't I do it? That's what I wanted to hear.
Right.
Great. This is why you can't do it. And once we kind of started communicating, my phone would ring. Coach, we got someone here. He's got this going on this lift. How can we adjust the lift but still do the lift? I'm like, yes, adjust it, still do the lift. That to me was where the magic started to happen. I think Joe Danos, who's now with the Giants right now, I've learned tons from him, because we were kind of cutting our teeth on both sides. He wanted to know about what I did in rehab, mm-hmm. and I didn't know what the hell he was doing with a clean and jerk. And I'm like, okay, why is that working? And all of a sudden, we did EMG studies and figured out that, hey, man, this is kind of cool stuff. There's something there, you know.
Right. I want to talk about your study. Tell me about that study you did on front squat versus back squat.
Well, one thing
what was the study exactly?
Basically, we wanted to look at glute max activation. Mm-hmm. And remember, in the 80s, we were teaching kids and coaches not to squat past 90 degrees. And what spawned out of that day was there was a surgery called the lateral release, which was something that treated patellofemoral pain. Unfortunately, we were probably causing the patellofemoral pain by stopping the athletes at 90 degrees of hip flexion and knee flexion, because at that point, it compressed the patella into the femur and didn't allow the knee to go through full range of motion.
At that exact point.
So with a full body squat where your hips go past 90 degrees and all the way down, we know that the patella glides through the whole patellofemoral joint mm-hmm. all the way through. So you load the whole patella, not just one component of it.
Right.
And in mid-range is where the most compressive forces occur. So when we were doing our squats to 90, we were compressing it and then uncompressing it and never letting it go through the full range. So that was one thing. Second thing is that we also noticed that no matter what we said in the 80s, from the physician standpoint, our Olympic lifting coaches still made their athletes, their butt went down their heels. Mm-hmm. They didn't care.
Right.
Why? Because for years and years and years, the Russians did it and everything. They knew that they had to stimulate that system through the full range of motion. So what was interesting is that we thought the glute, which is this big, massive muscle, and it's a giant ham hock, would be one of the most activated muscles in the lift because it's such a big muscle. And what we found is that...
What are you talking about specifically? Front squats?
Either squat? Any squat.
Got it.
So what we found was two things. One, with the squat, front or back, the glute really didn't activate much until you got past 90 degrees of hip flexion. Mm-hmm. It's the muscle that gets you out of the end range.
Got it.
The most active muscles were quad and hamstring. Eccentrically, it was hamstring, hamstring, hamstring. Glute activated at the bottom of the lift and then got you out of the lift and allowed quad and hamstring to get back up to lifting. So out of getting you out of the deep part of the lift, that's where the glute was the most active in the squat. It does do other things with lateral movement, but in the squat, that was it. Mm-hmm. One thing we also felt and kind of figured out was that when it came down to posterior chain activation, which is a buzzword when it comes down to deceleration, athleticism, accelerate, mm-hmm. all that stuff, and also injury prevention, the front squat, because of its position when it came to the center of gravity, activated the posterior chain throughout the whole lift much more than the back squat. I'm not saying the back squat's a bad lift, but when it comes down to loading, we got more posterior chain activation with less load with the front squat than we did with the back squat. Mm-hmm. We also kind of looked at that because most of the Olympic lifts, when it came down to any component of the clean and jerk, was you ended up in a front squatted position. Right. Okay, so for us, that was that seemed there was a reason that these lifts have been around forever. And we also noticed that our athletes tended to have poor form with back squatting. When we overloaded them, they would tend to hip hinge more and not use – they wouldn't sit back into the squat. They would actually do an early hip hinge and put more stress to their low back. Right. Whereas with the front squat, if they lost it, they could just drop the weight in front. Mm-hmm. Okay, and it promoted perfect form, just perfect form. So give me a kid who can front squat 200 pounds – he's probably as strong as a kid who can back squat 300 pounds.
Right.
I mean, with perfect form, you know, and understanding what, you know, where that correlates with fatigue and form and all that great stuff that goes with really teaching those
right.
lifts, you know.
Right. And in your personal training clients where you can be one-on-one every single session, are you still – or yeah, where do you use the back squat? Are you using it at all?
I can be totally honest with you. I probably don't mm-hmm. teach it. I don't do it. Personally, just because most of my clientele, I've got strength coaches that are dealing with more. I don't really deal with the Division I guys anymore right. or the pro guys. I'll let our other strength coaches handle that. I'm dealing with more the athlete that's getting back, and we're worried about loading him at a certain time.
Yep.
So we do it with that, but we also – I mean, we have a boot camp in the morning that incorporates lifts and movements and all that good mm-hmm. stuff, and my mean age is 55. And
right.
guess what? All of my athletes are are doing front squats. Mm-hmm. They'll do it with – I have training bars that start at 10 pounds and go up to a regular 45-pound Olympic bar. But we're using – we're finding also now that we're using med balls and that kind of thing. And I also think if you're looking at sports performance going forward, there's – if you understand the components of all the lifts that stimulate the system – you can adapt it. So I may not be doing the Olympic lift, but I'm doing components of the lift that stimulates the system the same way.
Hip extension, knee extension.
Exactly. And you know, if you look at the NFL, I mean, think about it. In the NFL, if you're a strength coach, it's probably not the smartest thing to do
right.
to incorporate very dynamic and risky lifts. But, boy, if you could find very safe ways to do these things mm-hmm. and still hit the system with the right stuff, you know, we're not making Olympic lifters. We're making football players. So
exactly.
it's components of those lifts that are the most important. And once you understand how the body likes to move, you can use that whether they're 8 or 80.
Right.
And that's the cool thing about give me a stick and a band and a 10-pound medicine ball, and I can wear you out no matter
right.
who you are. I'm just going to hit you in places you hadn't been hit before.
Yeah.
And that's the best part about it.
Right, so. Right. You're only as weak as you're only as strong as your weakest link, right? That
yeah.
kind of thing. I think it's funny how militant some people are on we have to back squat, that's the only way we're gonna reach, you know, maximum athletic potential, and it's a great lift, but there's so many other ways to get big and strong, right?
There's tons of ways to get big and strong, and again, we're talking about the back squat, but it's one of those things. Like I said, I think that there's some kids out there that I'm sure are really good back squatters that I may use that as a tool to load them, because maybe they're a better back squatter than a front squatter. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's from my standpoint, if I can get the same or better muscle activation with a less risky move, why not use that less risky mm-hmm. move? The other thing is that there's a civil war going on in strength training between guys who have been there from the get-go and done it a certain way and used the Bible of lifting
right.
as their – and the other guys who are seeing, well, maybe there's other ways to use that same information and adapt it to whatever the athlete I'm looking at. You know, we've worked with Coach Moffitt. We've had kids that come into the program there that, you know, are great athletes, but they could not load them in the weight room like they could everyone else. So they had to find another way to do that. That's the art of being a strength coach,
mm-hmm.
because can I have a vat of 80 athletes, and I may have 10% of those athletes that I can't load as much, or this one guy may overdose him in my lifting. I mean, basically you're a physician when you're a strength coach. You're dosing exercise like medication. So if I give a guy one aspirin every 10 days for a headache, it ain't going to work. But if I give him a whole bottle of aspirin, it's the last headache you'll ever have.
Right.
Same thing with lifting. I may have to move that pendulum back and forth based on each athlete, where in the bell-shaped curve, everyone can do my lifting routine. Mm-hmm. But I got those outliers I got to deal with. I think as you increase age, that outlier group gets bigger and bigger. As you have injury, that outlier group gets bigger and bigger, and you have to be able to adapt to that group. You can't just leave them in a corner alone. You know, they've got to do it. So I think that, you know, again, for me, a lunge is a component of a single leg front squat. I mean, it's the weight's in front of you, you go into a lunge, and it's a controlled environment, and you're in a tandem stance position, which makes it harder to do. So if I can lunge with 50 pounds, that may be even a better lift than a front squat. I mean, you have to kind of start playing with these things. And if you're doing the lifts with your clients, you notice that, boy, this really loaded me, you know, or combinations of things. We may do a front squat set and then combine that with side crawling. Right. Now all of a sudden you've got the athlete that they get up and their heart rate's been hit in a different plane. So they've worked in a sagittal plane, and all of a sudden they got loaded into a frontal plane when they got into the crawl position. Yeah. So now, wow, what have I done? I've taken one lift and made it a lift plus.
Right.
And I've also now dosed them now. So maybe I don't have to go into three major lifts today because I'm adding this component lift. You know, we still used to do the things where we do our front squats, clean pulls,
right,
and then we do our jerks. I mean, that's the mindset of an Olympic lift. I think you have to do that, but maybe not with my athletes who are going to be running or throwing a baseball or, you know, we've seen that with our baseball players, that if we don't change how we train them, they are set up for injury with these arms that are moving at speeds we can't even comprehend.
More than any other athlete, right?
Oh, yeah. Most definitely. It's asymmetric athletes are the most difficult to train in the weight room. So so my softball player, my baseball player, my overhead volleyball player,
golfers,
yep. Tennis, whenever you're that asymmetric athlete, you really got to – I think you still got to use what you do in a true strength training program, but also adapt it to you have an asymmetric athlete. So they're going to have one side that's way weaker than the other side. So you don't want to put them in a compromising position or put load in a compromising position of a joint that may have normal pathology. A baseball pitcher who throws the ball over 80 miles an hour, I promise you, has trophic changes in the upper part of his rotator cuff. He just does. Mm-hmm. It's not pathology, but if you MRI'd him, it looks like a partial tear.
When you throw 100 pitches, you know.
If you throw that hard, you can't throw that hard while having an adaptation. So now that you know you've got an athlete that has a functional adaptation that makes him good for this sport, for bad for others, you got to understand where the bad for others is, or you may hurt that athlete or set them up for injury.
Right.
So,
what do you think about this? If you have a football player that can squat 500 pounds and you take the weight off the bar and he can't do an air squat, what goes through your mind in that type of situation?
Then he has limited range of motion and limited flexibility. It's his limiting factor. Right. To me, that's, you know, it's like the old power lifters that used to wear the shirts, and they would bench press with a shirt that would really assist them in the lift. So I think you've got to work backwards into flexibility with that athlete, unload them, and get to a point where he can go through the full range of motion first, then start loading them up. So full range of motion with less load, to me, is way more athletic than partial range of motion with a ton of load, because that tells me that they're only strong in a certain range, not in the full range. Right. For injury prevention, think about it. Injuries normally don't occur in mid-ranges. It occurs when you get to extreme ranges, and that's where the problem can occur. Hyperextension of the knee will tear the ACL.
Right.
You know, the knee shifting in what we call a lockman or in a pivot shift position when you're loading, it's when the system breaks down in those different weird ranges that you can't predict. Mm-hmm. So you have to train the full range, and flexibility is a component of strength. You have to be able to do that. So,
I love it. All right, I want to talk about development a little bit. You work with a lot of kids, right?
Yes.
If you have a new kid come in, he's got nothing wrong with him, good range of motion. Where are you going with him? You see maybe he's a freshman in high school. He wants to come to you until he graduates high school. What's your goal with him?
Initially, we have to figure out where his awareness of his body is in space is. So we start with basic stuff. Can he hop? Can he skip? Can he jump? Can he front squat? Can he do body weight stuff? Can he do a push-up? Can he crawl? Do all those functional movement things that they are baseline. He's got to be able to do this. once he kind of gets to the point where he is a functioning in all the ranges and all the planes that he can, we will then start a loading component. And that may be, we may not put him on a platform to do a real front squat for weeks until he can do a med ball front squat, and then progress them through a progression that gets them into the, some of our basic loads. We love the combination of push-ups. We love the combination of lunge walks in conjunction with your typical lifts. We don't do a lot of bench press, of course. You know, if he's an old lineman, we may do dumbbell inclines. We may do things like that to engage. But we're going to do a lot of hip activation, a lot of band work for lateral hip activation, monster work, Groucho walks. Combine that with that.
And let's dive into that a little bit. A little bit more. The lateral movement, glute activation.
Yeah.
Why is that so important to you?
In stance, in single limb stance, and in running. So running is basically one single limb stance after another. One of the main things that helps control knee position is lateral glute or lateral hip activation. So hip abduction away from centerline, its strength in stance is an indicator of where the knee is. For us, that's a great indicator of everything. Athletic position, great indicator of when we have ground reaction speed. It creates a stable platform. So the hip glute area is the rotator cuff of the lower extremity. As it goes, everything else goes. We all talk about rotator cuff injuries with our upper body athletes, and that usually goes from, starts honestly from shoulder blade scapular instability, okay? So the glute and the hip complex is that scapula for the lower body. Right. If it's weak, I don't care what their quads look like. I don't care what their hamstrings look like. They can look like a Greek god. If that doesn't work, they're going to break down. Basically, we use basically frontal plane movement, so hip abduction, monster walk. So they're in stance, but we're overstimulating the glute med, overstimulating the abductors in stance, and it eliminates a lot of those pathologic movements. We see it mostly with developmental females, 12, 13, 14. You know, it's funny. Puberty seems to be the place where we miss the boat in the United States. We don't train our kids at the right time frames. I'm not saying we have to load our kids, but we're not teaching them these basic component movements. And with girls, it's 11, 12, 13, and boys, it's 12, 13, 14, because that's when hormones hit. And God's anabolic steroid is hormones. We all talk about these kids who are just naturally strong, and there's a reason where gymnasts are strong for life, because during those developmental years, they're throwing their bodies around, okay? Coach Hatch and the really good Olympic lifting coaches want those kids at 10, 11, because that's where they baseline. That's where it's all – you're fertilizing the garden. And once – it's funny. Once you – we had an O-lineman in college one time. The guy was 6'5 and 300 pounds. But he did gymnastics when he was real young. The guy could still do a cartwheel and a backflip. So that's inherent strength, you know. So for us, if we can get that kid at that age, we can start building, and all of a sudden we notice as they start to progress their strength, now we can start challenging them. Now we'll start teaching them lifts. We'll start loading. And we can put them on a table of loading, unloading, and really start almost using the mindset of a D1 coach when it comes down to periodization and all those things. But dumb it down. We don't need to do crazy stuff, but dumb it down just to get these kids. And guess what? Their speed increases, their strength increases, and their chance of injury goes down. And, you know, by the time they get to the high schools, especially the football and baseball players here, these high schools have a good understanding of what they're doing. They're going in there, let them load them. That's great. You're going to do that. You want to – that's nice.
They're definitely going to load them.
Well, and what we do is, can we do the component things that allows them to be loaded there? Right. Comes down to female sports, that's a whole different story. We don't have, especially in our area here, I don't think we have the baseline of strength training that we should have with our female athletes. And you know, the problem with that is, number one, the schools aren't prepared for it. And number two, we thought year-round sports were bad for boys. They're, if not worse, for girls. I mean, volleyball has probably a month to 2 months off.
You said you thought, or it is.
It is. It's just as bad or worse. Yep. You know, soccer is almost a 12-month-a-year sport.
Right.
You know, volleyball is a 10-month-a-year sport. Baseball, we know about baseball being a year-round sport. Softball is being a year-round sport. It seems that our mindset of getting our kids exposure and to better talent and to coaching is really in the club and the non-high school. It's the adjunct programs that are out there. And so we end up with these kids who are overloaded and don't have time for, quote-unquote, an off-season. You know, most of our kids don't get really good strength training programs till they get to college, you know, because they don't have the time to.
You know, and what do you think – what's the most important – what are the most important things that happen or should happen in the off season?
Initially, rest. And then starting to work them in planes that they don't normally do. Mm-hmm. So if I have a sprint athlete that's running in a sagittal plane a bunch, I'm going to do a lot of lateral hip activation and work in those opposite planes. Right. I'll do dynamic lunges. I'll do curtsy lunges, side lunges, that kind of thing. And then as soon as I feel that they've recovered from their season, go into initially a loading program where I'm, you know, starting to really gain load, do some really true strength development. Right. While doing that, maintaining some flexibility, maintaining some foot position stuff, load them as much as I can, and then give them a 2-week ramp up to their next season where we go into dynamic movements, speed, agility, foot position movements. We'll bring Vertimax stuff in there. We'll do the speed, we'll do all that stuff. Right. And then at that point, use our lifts to maintain whatever strength we were able to build during that initial phase or that beginning to first third phase of what we're doing. Right. Unfortunately, we don't have a true off season where I've got the kids 6 months of just, you know, building themselves back up. It may be a 1 month to 2 month thing. Many of our athletes that go from high school to college come back and tell us, I've never had this much time to rest. I've never had this much time to really develop my body. Whereas that should be done during the developmental ages, not when they're they finish developing by the time you get to college. Unless you're a late bloomer male, you're not going to be in a college playing a sport being a late bloomer male. So the idea is you need to, you know, build, I mean, we should be thinking of those things, not just at 10, 11, 12, you know, looking at it at 8, 9, and 10. Mm-hmm. Are our PE programs, which are going away, the dodo bird, building our athletes up in a way that teaches them those normal movement patterns? Not just athletes, our non-athletes. If you're a chess player, you should be able to catch a ball.
Everybody should be able to move correctly, right?
Bingo. One day it's going to come in. Right. You have to catch a pair of keys from somebody one day.
Right. So, because we have all these luxuries that we don't have to anymore. So, yeah, it does fall in the schools, huh?
Yeah.
So, glute active. We were talking about glutes, mm-hmm. and I stopped you. Then what are you working on?
Once we go from glute activation, to be honest with you, then we go scapular stability.
Okay.
So,
and core, this is before core?
No, it's all –
that's part of your core.
Okay. So, let's define core.
Yep.
Core, we feel, is from the clavicles to the pelvic floor. Okay, so core incorporates the pelvic floor, transverse abdominis. It's not the rectus abdominis, which we always think. It's not the six-pack abs. You can have six-pack abs, but that doesn't mean you don't have a bad core.
Right.
The diaphragm, so breathing. We also put into that serratus anterior and the scapular stabilizers.
Okay.
So if you have an athlete that's got winging scapula, you know they have a bad core. I don't care what their abs look like, their core's bad.
Mm-hmm.
If you have an athlete who's got an asymmetric love handles on one side as opposed to the other, they have a bad core. If you have an athlete that has a flattened glute, they've also got a bad core. So all those things start to the crawling and planking and all the things that we're mm-hmm. doing now, which I think are fantastic. Think about it. A plank position. If we put an athlete in a plank position, they've got to fire their serratus anterior, which stabilizes the scapula on the spinous border. They've got to fire their abdominal wall, okay, and not in a crunch position, but in a stable holding position where the whole abdominal complex surrounding from the low back to the front is firing kind of in a corset manner.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to reflexively fire their pelvic floor. That's it. It's hard to teach an athlete to fire their pelvic floor. It should be a reactionary muscle, not mm-hmm. a muscle that – you know, you can wow them at parties if you can fire your pelvic floor, but it shouldn't fire, you know, voluntarily. It should be a reflex muscle. One thing we also need to keep in mind is that there's the training we do, you have to keep in mind that the body thinks of movement as two different things, and where we break down is the thing we don't think about. One thing is when I go to pick up a ball or pick up an object or do a voluntary movement, that's my brain putting me through the process. What we don't know is there's a subconscious, a non-conscious component that predicts the movement before you do it. And that is where we break down. So when no one thinks about when they're running and they go to cut to fire glute hamstring a certain way, it just kind of happens. Mm-hmm. To be honest with you, right before your foot hits the ground to cut, the body's already thinking about how to fire it before it even hits the ground.
Okay.
When that little bit of, you know, amateurization phase or between contraction phase gets too wide or gets slack, mm-hmm. we get an injury. So when it comes to core activation, we want to do things that also make it fire statically but also dynamically. That's when you go from static planking into crawling because it's got to react. The kid's not – the athlete or the adult's not worried about core. They're worried about, oh, my God, am I putting my hand the right way? Am I going to – my hand's going to give way. Is my shoulder going to give way?
Right.
That's where you start and that's where you start looking at the philosophy of doing a regular you know, single-plane lift but incorporating a functional – movement right after that to incorporate in the body's neural system, neural pathway. Mm-hmm. And it wants to learn the way it developed. It developed squatting, it developed rolling, developed crawling. It's DOS. It's the basic operating system in your brain. If you always go back to that, mm-hmm. you know, maybe it didn't know how to do a kettlebell swing. Okay. I've never seen a 2-year-old do a kettlebell swing, but I still think kettlebell swings are interesting and key. But if I combine a kettlebell swing with a pull-up or with a push-up, I'm incorporating that dynamic movement back right. into the body's system. So, you know, the core, the glute, we start with that and we work our way out from there. You know, if we want to, once we go into more dynamic movements, it's there. But EMG-wise, remember, when I'm doing a front squat, my core is firing like crazy.
Right.
Okay. So my precursors always to that are activating that. And my precursor to any evolution of my exercise program has to incorporate activating that first and then going into my other component stuff.
Right. Yeah. I really, really love the part about the core. People aren't doing a whole lot of dynamic core work in any field. And that was key for me in my recovery. It you know, even if it's just it was less boring than a plank, you know.
Yes.
It gave me something to shoot for, and it worked like hell. Like you said, as soon as you get on all fours and start moving, you're gonna be fucking gassed.
Yeah.
So that was true for sure. Let me think. Let's take a short break.
Sounds good.
Hey, y'all. This is Brooke Entz, and you're listening to Brute Strength Podcast.
All right. Can you tell me a couple – tell me about some of your favorite athletes. I'm curious, some of the freakish things they've done.
I guess, you know, one of the – we were recently, after being with the Saints and working with a few guys, one of the most dynamic athletes I've worked with is probably Jabari Greer, and only because we've kind of seen Jabari – come from his original injury all the way back, but just to see
what was that
dramatic torn ACL PCL everything to his knee was torn. It was one of the last playoff games a couple years ago with the Saints, and to see him come back from such a dramatic injury and come back and still going through rehab, but moving in ways that only certain people could move the way he does, and when I say that. After years and years of doing this, I can pick a superior athlete out if they're jogging. There's certain things, you know, people can talk about being a great strength coach and a speed coach and all this good stuff. And I hear guys brag all the time that, oh, so-and-so came and worked with us and, you know, he ran a 4.3. That guy was going to run a 4.3 no matter what you did. You just can't screw it up.
Right.
The idea is to not screw it up. And those are the athletes that make us look good. And he's one of those guys that make us.
I can't let you skip over this though. What do you see when you see it?
So if I had two guys jogging, same pace, same turnover. The superior athlete moves his body through space faster and with more distance with less effort.
Right.
And it is you know, for those of you out there who work with these people, you know it. When you see it, you know it. You know. Mm-hmm. I can tell a kid that walks in here if they have potential to develop into something in about 5-10 minutes because we do a dynamic movement screen, but then we also have the kid do stuff like skips and hops and sidesteps and have them run, and they just move differently.
Right.
And they move the way the books say you should, you know. And it's kind of funny. I've learned quickly that the greatest strength coaches take kids who don't move in those planes and get them close to being there.
Right.
I think there's also a curtain that limits you from going at a certain level. If you don't have it, you don't have that God-given dynamic strength. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot you can do with kids and athletes that don't have it. I mean, there's something to be said for work ethic and skill set and learning a craft. But there's certain things that you just see in certain athletes that migrate you to them to work with them because right. you know that this is something special. You know, right. and so Jabari is definitely one of them. And we had a young man that we actually did two of his ACLs reconstruction, and is one of the most dynamic athletes. Actually, probably the best athlete I've ever worked with, mm-hmm. from just a total body. A kid named Austin Ray, who and if Austin's probably listening to this, he's probably gonna laugh.
I'll try to throw some videos up on the
probably the most. One of the most violent tumblers I've ever met in my entire life. This is a kid that tore his ACL once. We actually brought him to full rehab. I also remember during the rehab phase when he was still not released for anything, I found out that he was at the gym one night, and I showed up, and he was tumbling handstand to handstand and negating the use of his legs because he was, quote-unquote, listening to me and not using his legs. But he can move and do things, you know, you see at Cirque du Soleil, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. A very muscular, athletic athlete that tells you that stimulating your body in these different planes will keep it fit and keep it explosive, and you can overcome huge, you know, deficits. This is a kid that tore his ACL one year, tore the other ACL the next year, and now is walking around with two brand new, you know, totally reconstructed knees. And you can't, unless you really know, you can't, even if you know what you're looking at, you can't tell that there's anything going on with this guy. He right. has never lost any muscle bulk, and the explosiveness and athleticism, like I said, I could put him up against any athlete in the world and he would hang, right. as far as showing you dynamic ability to move your body through space. And that's mm-hmm. athleticism. What's that, being an athlete? It's how can I move my body through space, whether it be in any plane of movement, in any position, mm-hmm. Compared to the guy next to me, right. you know, that correlates in the speed, agility, however you want to call it. And then that to me is, it's not how much you can bench. It's how much you can move this body that you have. And maybe the bench helps you get there,
right.
but that's not really it. You know,
and move in every movement pattern that you're going to be asked
exactly.
in your sport, right?
Exactly. It's funny is that we had a young lady who was a triathlete of ours. And usually, you know, the endurance athletes aren't very good with the speed components mm-hmm. of stuff. They're very good at, you know, running you down for 20 miles because mm-hmm. and they have a different type of athleticism. It doesn't maybe look as athletic as other things, but they can do it. But, you know, it's funny. You find those ones, and if you look at the ones who are elite, they can do everything. So they can also do icky shuffle speed ladder drills.
Right.
They can front squat. They can do all those things, and they look like the guy who may be the pro football player. So you put them in the same room, different body types, but they're moving in the same way. And mm-hmm. it's kind of interesting how you know, again, you can use it to correlate it with any sport, but whether it's baseball, softball, you can see the athletes that are going to be very successful in whatever sport they would go into.
Right.
You know, they just picked one and went with it, you mm-hmm. know. So
I love it. I'm gonna ask you like a few popcorn questions here. Can you remember maybe your biggest or one of your biggest mistakes that you've made as a strength and conditioning coach / rehab specialist?
Probably the thing that we used to do, the worst thing we did, especially in the 80s and early 90s, is that we would rehab people to the point where on paper they were finished. Mm-hmm. And what does that mean? That means that, for instance, a knee, they have full knee range of motion, their heel can touch their butt, full knee extension, they can do a leg press their body weight, and they can walk without a limitation, and they could jog in our clinic without a limitation. We would discharge them. Mm-hmm. If you took that person out of our facility and walked them to a field, a football field, and had them run, it looked like there's something so wrong with them that not even funny. But they were out of sight, out of mind at then. According to the books, they were done. There was a back when I was just a tech, I remember we used to do a lot of what's called isokinetic testing, which would be these big computerized machines, and you see it on one of the Rocky movies where the guy's pushing against the lever arm and he's measuring how much torque he's produced in a seated knee extension position. We thought that meant that was athleticism. We learned a lesson in the late 80s. We had a football team in out of Cameron, Louisiana. And Cameron was kind of in a very, place that was hard to get to. And they had a really great 1A football team. And we were doing a study where we pulled all of our ACL kids back in after a year and retested them. So kids who had ACL reconstruction, sent them back to their schools, wanted to retest them and see where they were on their progress. And what's funny is that all the kids in the city who had access to our high-end equipment, all the other stuff came in. And when we got them on the computerized testing equipment, they tested out the wazoo. Mm-hmm. But we put them in the functional position. We had them do a shuttle run, a single leg hop, a high jump. They actually scored 50% less compared to the kids from Cameron. So we're like, wait a minute, these kids are down in Nowheresville. Mm-hmm. How are they doing this? What's funny is that we sent some trainers down there, and what we found was that the high school was across the street from the beach. So the coach didn't have equipment, but he had a beach.
Yep.
So he had the guys going out there where they'd walk ankle deep in the water, then they'd walk knee deep in the water.
Yeah.
Then he'd have them jumping in the water. He had them running in the water. He had doing all that stuff in the sand. He had them doing that. He had them doing stadiums. They were carrying sacks of oyster sacks with 50 pounds of oysters. They were doing all this stuff, all this dynamic strength stuff. And we had these kids come in, and they were symmetrical. They were athletic. They were. And what we found, and that's where we started looking at things like, why does a Snap Fitness, which is a great place, I'm sure, why does a machine-based program not correlate into athleticism, whereas your better gyms have very little equipment, and it's the body moving it through space? And that was kind of the aha moment. Oh, my God, we have missed the boat. We really thought that, high tech and ton of equipment means that you had a great program, and it's really not that. It's more, how does the body move? And it's a lot more gray matter involved with strength training now.
Right.
It's not, it's not Hans and Franz. It's not that, we use the old saying when you see the guy who's really completely bowed up and over muscular in the gym, if he gets his hand on you, you're right, but he's got to be able to catch you first, and you start running in a serpentine fashion, he's going to break an ankle.
Right.
That's what we think has changed the most. And, there's an old saying, stuff I'm teaching now in 10 years will probably be malpractice. And I think that's the evolution of everything. I think strength training, when I was there, was bench, squat, deadlift. Mm-hmm. That made an athlete. And at the time, that was probably sufficient.
Right.
But, when you start looking at a 165-pound lifter who's an Olympic lifter can clean and jerk 350, wait a minute, we screwed up. And that's what really spawned all this stuff with – we worked with Joe Danos, and we worked with some of the descendants of Gail Hatch, and find out how are they creating these superior athletes, and their, the power to weight ratio of their body was way ahead of, everybody else training a different way. It was just pretty awesome stuff. I guess that's the, there's been hiccups off and on, but things like that are the things that I think of that have pushed us in a direction, and finding out also what, we also make the mistake in the United States that we know what we're doing and that we're the best minds out there. And when you start going to these other countries and you find out that, we were walking in the Czech Republic and into a gym, and they had a big area that was nothing but pebbles. Mm-hmm. And it was rocks, and it was a box of rocks. And I'm like, they had their athletes barefoot walking in these rocks forward, backwards, and they were doing, squatting on these rocks with no weight on and all this stuff. I'm like, what kind of Flintstone stuff is this? go do it. And if you're like, oh my God, this is very hard. And what they did was that those rocks caused pain. So if you didn't have normal weight, perfect technique, it hurt.
Yeah.
So sometimes pain goes a long way. And it was like, this is brilliant. It's a box of rocks, but damn, they know what they're doing.
Right.
A sand pit. Every major organization has a sand pit now. Why? Because, if I got my old linemen going through their blocking progressions in sand, how much faster are they going to be when they're on a turf field with the right shoes?
And if they're not doing it correctly, they're going to fall on their ass.
Bingo. Yeah. I mean, sadly, it comes down to the basics, dude. You don't need $1 million in equipment to create $1 million people, you know. And again, it goes down to what I want people to understand and everybody to understand is that it comes down to, you know, the people you're working with have to have the gray matter to adapt to you. You know, and there are programs out there.
Break it down even more for us.
So you can't train an athlete the same way you train every athlete. Mm-hmm. If you don't walk into a place and they don't take into account your body type, your flexibility issues, your strength deficits, and your sport that you're going to, if you're given a program or you're put into a group and everyone's doing the same exact thing right. all the time, maybe there's something there. Right. You know, and if you're repeating the same thing over and over again, mm-hmm. you're not getting dynamically stimulated. They're not giving you all that they can, right. you know. And you know, some of that's volume issues, and let's just face it, it's all about time and money. But, mm-hmm. you know, if people out there want to make a difference, find a place that when you ask them why I'm doing this, mm-hmm. they better give you a damn good reason why you're doing it. Not because, well, I did it when I was in college and I'm fast. No.
Right.
I don't care about that. If you want to go, you know, if you want to work out with Biff and Buffy and look like them, and that's great. I mean, mm-hmm. but that's not where it all comes from. You know, it comes Absolutely. From a lot different. You know, the best strength coaches in the world don't look like their strength coaches, probably.
Right. Right.
You know, they're kind of beat up a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I've only been out of CrossFit for 2 years now, and we're already doing almost completely different things. You know, we've adapted and done completely different things than what we did to win 2 world championships. So even at that level, we've constantly got to adapt. So I'm a huge believer in that. What are your top 3 exercises for injury prevention that you think everyone should be doing?
I say top 3 things. I think dynamic
or however many.
Dynamic push-ups and crawls are for upper extremity prevention.
What's a dynamic push-up?
Dynamic push-up would be push-ups not just in a normal push-up position. Mm-hmm. Push-up, then you change hand position. Stagger the hands up and back.
Okay.
Stagger hands the opposite direction. Push-ups with Spider-Mans, where you push up and one knee comes up to the elbow, mm-hmm. other knee comes up. So just changing up the push-up in ways, gotcha. Adding speed with your push-up. That's the other thing you got to keep in mind. You can add plyometrics. You can pop up a little bit and land. In the crawls, that would be another thing with both core and push-up. And
I'm
again,
to throw a video of a correct crawl as well. I think there's a lot of people out there that are going to be.
If your butt's up in the air, it ain't a prostate exam. It's got to be. I mean, we call it bear crawls. It's probably better to call it Spider-Man crawls. If you look like Spider-Man, that's probably where you need to be. Mm-hmm. Probably for lower body stuff, combination of squats and dynamic lunges. And we say dynamic lunges, star lunges, so front 45, 90-degree right. lunge, and a drop-step lunge. And then we front squats just for hip activation, the whole lower body mm-hmm. activation. Single-leg stuff and single-limb balance. So if you look at a cycle or an exercise progression, maybe in one of your stations, you would have just a balance station where the athlete is barefoot on a somewhat of a noxious surface, a surface they don't like to be on,
right.
and doing, you know, opposite leg movements while they're balancing, and also teaching them what an athletic position is. We are amazed every day of what people think a squat should look like mm-hmm. and what they think an athletic position should look like. And it's really scary right. as to what – unfortunately, parents and people say, oh, they play the sport well, so they must be athletic. That's not really true. Mm-hmm. You can be a very good baseball player and not be athletic.
Right.
When you get to a certain level, it's going to bite you. But if you're the littlest kid on the team when you're real young and you're faster than everybody else, because everybody's growing, you know, the big goofy kid looks goofy at 11, mm-hmm. but the big goofy kid who grows into his body at 14 is going to leave you behind.
Right.
So it's understanding what athleticism is, also understanding that an athlete at the end of his season is less athletic than he was at the beginning, but maybe performing right. better because he's
higher skill.
His skill is he's learned his craft. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the other thing is maintaining those progressions during the season. No, I may not load my athlete, but man, everybody should be doing body weight lunges, squats, star steps,
right.
planks, push-ups, side crawls, you know, all those types of things to hopefully maintain some form of athleticism as you go forward. And it comes back to, you know, if we had to rename our gym, probably called the Big Ass Gym, because if you have a nice glute, you're probably in a good, yes. you're a good athlete. Yes. So, for lack of a better word, we're going to start with the ass and work our way out. And that's just, you know, that's how it's evolved. I mean, it seems to be, you know, I always come back to the basics. We seem to keep evolving back to that, those right. needs. You know, to me, that's, if you picked our core, what we start with, you want to reopen a gym and say, I suck. Well, start with that and you're probably going to start okay. You know?
Yep.
So.
This is no bullshit. Since you know, going through the exercises you gave me, the whole progression, amongst my group of close friends, like, my ass is a real, like, I don't know what the word would be. There's a lot of attention drawn to it. It was big.
I don't know if that's good, right?
It was good. So it was like I had lordosis
right.
all growing up, and then, you know, butt kind of flattened out after surgery, mm-hmm. and then I just fucking pounded all of the core, the glute work. And I've never felt better. I've never felt better in my life. I'm, you know, I can work out hard and it doesn't affect me the same way. I walk around differently. I recover differently. It's phenomenal. Phenomenal stuff. So if people want to find you, where do they go?
They go to our Total Package website. They can call our office at 504-818-2300 or 305-00-0097. They can also
they can do consults with you
yes.
on the phone. Okay.
So once they contact us and we get their information, we can do consults. What I do is we carve out time during the day that I can do phone consults or over the internet. Mm-hmm. We've had people send me videos. This is right. what I look like, and you know, a lot of stuff can be done, you know, with technology now, with Skype and everything,
right.
you can do a lot of stuff via that. And you know, we also want to see ourselves as a resource for. And look, I'll be the first to tell you, dude, I don't know it all. And to me, that's my best asset is I can tell you that I don't know, but I have enough people. I'm connected with smarter people than me that right. I can figure it out. You know, that the other thing I tell you, if you ever go to someone, they say they know it all, and this is the end-all, be-all, I have spent a lot of money and time trying to find out what the hell the end-all, be-all is.
Right.
I haven't found it yet, dude. I'm getting close, I think, right. but, you know, it's funny that in the last 7 years, the stuff we finally kind of chiseled it down to has been some of the stuff that has not been contradicted like some of our other stuff. Mm-hmm. We used to think we knew it, and right. every year somebody would do something that would blow us out of the water. We've really been okay now. Mm-hmm. And it's funny, if you look at the performance guys out there on the performance side and then the high-end guys on the rehab side, everyone's starting to talk the same language again. I think that, to me, just recertifies that we're on the right track.
Right.
And you know, you know, everyone says, well, you know, do I need a strength coach and a speed coach? I said, no, you need someone that can dynamically strength train you.
Right.
You will be faster. You will be stronger. You will be all those things. If you start carving and whittling it out, you're going to have a whittled out, carved out way of,
right.
you know, growing. And it just doesn't work that way. So I mean, like I said, I think we're on to something. But, I mean, we're far away from finding what the answer is.
Right. Well, like I said, I have a tremendous amount of respect for you. And I've seen a lot of the best coaches in the country, strength coaches, and you are right up there at the top.
I appreciate it, man. It means a lot.
I appreciate the time. And if you haven't subscribed to the newsletter already, go to the website, get on the newsletter.